think it sounds like it could be very doable. Do you believe it's worth the effort to look into this, Dick? Over.
I think the answer is yes, Mel. But you said one thing that I disagree with a little bit. You led me to believe that if we build the antenna elements in this bell-shaped curve, that we're going to get more gain. I agree with that. And you said that you think that the antenna left to right will have the same dimensions as an ordinary Yagi. There I don't agree. If you're going to get more gain, you can only get it by using more real estate. If I set up a Lansdorfer-like bell-shaped set of elements on a three-element Yagi, and if, for instance, I made the individual elements physically three half wavelengths long, where I've got a half wavelength of element to the left of the center of the bell-shaped curve, a half wavelength of element to the right, and the bell shape itself, which is a kind of a hairpin, is another half wave. When you put either quarter wave or half wave, I think it's quarter wave. When you put a quarter wave hairpin between the left side and the right side of an antenna, set up correctly, it will create a phase reversal across the hairpin, which is the right way to do so that the left-hand dipole and the right-hand dipole come out in phase. You want the right-hand side of the left-hand dipole and the left-hand side of the right-hand dipole to be 180 degrees out of phase. And the hairpin can do that for you. A quarter wave shorted hairpin will do that. And it becomes a little bit more difficult to see the hairpin when you make it a more rounded on the corners, so it's a bell-shaped device instead of a hairpin built with 90-degree elbows to it. But that's just minor details. But that extra gain is coming from more real estate. You are approaching the technique of having a pair of horizontally displaced three-element Yagis when you make each one of those elements three half-wavelengths long, which I think is required to get the 3 dB of gain, and maybe a little bit less than three half-wavelengths, one and a half-wavelengths. But so you're not going to get more gain without using more real estate, whether you're building vertically stacked Yagis, horizontally stacked Yagis, collinear array, whatever. You can't get gain without devoting more real estate, with rare exception. That's my feeling on that one now, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
BBK-STOW-EW requested.
Hey, go ahead, Howie.
I remember seeing TV antennas that looked like inverted beads lying on their sides. Remember when they didn't have the element coming out straight like a beam, but they had them coming out at like a 45-degree angle or more, Dick? What antenna was that?
TV he's talking about.
Yeah. I owned one of those antennas in the 1957 or so time frame. Weingard? I'm trying to remember the brand name now. But it was a popular antenna at that time. And the fact that they're in a V-shape, that in itself doesn't necessarily give you more gain. The V-shaped stack of elements with crisscross feeding is a kind of a V-shaped log periodic. And you can properly tune, get more bandwidth out of that antenna with reasonable gain. That was a so-called fringe area antenna that I was using on top of the house in Middle Island in the late 50s, and it worked very well. Wish I could remember the brand name of that V-shaped Yagi and television receiving antenna. Back to you, Howie.
That's what I want to know. Now, this Landorf, I don't know what a Landorf is. Maybe I haven't seen it since I lost my eyesight. But what is a Landorf antenna?
AFD antenna you were talking about, Dick.
You think it was JFD? Maybe it was. I'm trying to remember the brand name. It was a popular brand name of television aerial at the time. If instead of having a half wavelength dipole and half wavelength long approximately director and reflector, if you start off with a longer piece of wire for the a longer piece of tubing, let's say, for the dipole element, whether it be parasitic or driven, almost doesn't matter. Start off with one that's either a wavelength or one and a half wavelength long, but bend it in a way that makes it look like a bell-shaped curve, a Gaussian-shaped curve. You bend it into a Gaussian-shaped curve, but now all of that bend is in one plane, and you lay that plane parallel to the ground, and you build three of those elements in a very similar manner, stack them up, all the plane of the bell-shaped curve is parallel to the ground for all three elements, and you set them up with the element, one out in front that you call director, one in the middle you call driven element, one back you call reflector, and they're all bent. It's a more exotic bend compared to the V-shaped log periodic that you and I know about. That's essentially what Lansdorff is. L-A-N-D-S-T-O-R-F-E-R. L-A-N-D-S-T-O-R-F-E-R, I think is the spelling. Lansdorfer. Lansdorfer. Lansdorfer, T-O-R-F-E-R. So I wonder if you sort of get the picture of that one, Howie, go ahead.
And I understand, it looked like bell-shaped, like a Gaussian distribution. Now, what is the impedance that you have to match these antennas, and does it, and it gives you more gain, and what about bandwidth?
Bandwidth I don't know about. Impedance doesn't matter, because if the antenna is anything from 1,500 ohms resistive down to 10 ohms resistive, you and I know ways of building an antenna tuner, an impedance matching network, or whatever. So the impedance is not a showstopper. Bandwidth, I don't think it's got more bandwidth, but it might. But because it's got more real estate, it has the ability to get more gain. That's my take on it. I think Mel's gone a little bit further than I have, and he's gotten more articles on it. Let's see what Mel's got to say about your questions. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, the only thing that I don't understand, I can understand your theory, Dick, and I can more or less, I guess, agree with it. And I can see that, according to him, the Lansdorfer is not going to take up that much extra because, I guess, the bell shaping of it sort of, you know, reduces what would be a horizontal distance between, you know, from one tip of the element to the other. However, what I don't quite understand is this business that they're taking a standard vertical, and here's exactly the way it is quoted. That taking a, he took a standard vertical and modified the standard vertical into a question mark, and they basically, it happened to them at the 3Y0PI at DX Expedition. Our vertical antenna got scrunched into what you would call, looked like a big question mark. And then we found by our contacts with our regular stations that we kept in contact with, that we were picking up 3 to 4 dB better signal reports and receiving just by what Mother Nature did. So, trying to get your bent the bends, Ham, let's bend our vertical antennas. This is quoted right from the 3Y0PIDX expedition. I mean, this is the Antarctic lizard that reshaped the vertical antenna and made it work better, Dick, over.
A comment on that, Dick?
Yeah, I believe he saw a 3 or more dB of gain increase. However, what's not clearly defined so far is what was he starting with. If the original antenna had some kind of an error, insufficient counterpoise, improperly tuned counterpoise, improper connections, and when you're in the Arctic, it's very easy to get an improper connection to your eye with the ice around that antenna. It may look like everything is connected correctly, and maybe it wasn't. So after this windstorm that bent the antenna into a question mark shape, because we are not really sure. He doesn't have traceable to the Bureau measurements as to what was the performance of the antenna at the beginning of the incident versus what was the performance at the end. All we know is that 3 dB of increased signal strength took place, and there's lots of ways that that can happen. He's changing the altitude off the ground that the phase center occurred. Maybe he's also changing how much horizontal versus vertical polarization. There's a slim chance that Mother Nature, over that tremendous distance he's communicating, at the same time after the storm that bent up the antenna, that the propagation itself changed. There's a lot of variables in here, and it's a little bit difficult to pin it down by saying that just the question mark shape did it. Because if so, when he brings that question mark bent antenna back home and makes measurements, I'd love to see what kind of performance he really got on a good antenna range. So I'm not completely on the bandwagon yet that question mark did all of that work. Go ahead, Howie, K2RIW.
Okay, I tell you what, I've seen things like that happen. I've actually seen CB antennas back when I was playing around with CB and 10 meters, where, let's say, a ground plane got bent. What's probably happening, Dick, I don't think he's getting more game, but it may be favoring in that particular direction. You know, you may have more signal going in one area than going in a less of an area because you changed the pattern.
Yeah, there's a lot of way the pattern could have changed. The azimuthal pattern could have changed. The elevation pattern could have changed. The phase center off the ground, and therefore the launching angle, and Mother Nature's propagation, and whether or not the antenna was performing correctly at the beginning of the experiment. I'd like to believe that if he was measuring standing wave ratio, he had reasonable connections to begin with. I'd love to know what was the standing wave ratio after the question mark. Did the transmitter always put out the same power? Well, it's more than just transmitter, because he was getting 3 dB of increase on both transmit and receive. There's lots of evidence there that the antenna system, antenna, impedance matching, transmission line, antenna tuner, but that whole system turned into a better system after the windstorm that bent up the antenna into the question mark shape. K2KEY, K2LIW.
According to Landsdorfer, he wasn't surprised that he said he had duplicated the same experiment. Under controlled conditions, and according to the DXX position, though it had nothing to do with one particular direction, this was reports from all over the world that they had, and their signals had improved on that particular antenna, that they, the vertical antenna that they were using. I think it was a full-size 40-meter commercial, one of the commercial antennas, if I'm not mistaken. I don't think it was a situation there of any connections or anything like that. Something happened, whether the propagation suddenly changed so drastically and continued that way for a period of time or whatever. Again, you got to do it under controlled conditions. According to Landsdorfer, he did it under controlled conditions, using maybe an antenna range or whatever, but he took supposedly two exact, well, in fact, he said he did it with even dipoles on 80 meters. He says, here, I got this post that somebody sent me. The Landsdorfer dipoles don't look particularly pretty, and they are hard to support mechanically. But they do show an improvement in dipole performance. In fact, his verticals, when you look at them, they look like scrunched affairs. I guess the closest you can imagine, they are shaped in the form of large question marks. This is all I've got on it, Dick. I don't know. The ideal answer would be, of course, is to duplicate the experiment. But according to Landsdorfer, he's been there and did it, and I don't know. He said hopefully there'll be some antennas showing up on the market with this type of configuration in the next couple of years, Dick. Over.
All I can say is that back when I was on a low band, I made antennas look like S's and different shapes. Now, you know what? They work. Sometimes they work better, sometimes they don't work better, Dick.
Out with the Landsdorfer.
See,
I didn't know what I was doing. I would just take wire and just make loop antennas, zigzag them on the roof, whatever I could do.
Mel, the 3Y0PI expedition, de-expedition. How long ago did that take place? The possibility existed that they had this great big windstorm. At the end of the windstorm, they had rather different propagating conditions. That's a variable. And if that de-expedition was, let me pick a number, 8 years ago, I'm a little bit unhappy about the fact that somebody in that 8 years hasn't come out with a commercial product giving all this extra performance. How back to you, Mel. How long ago was it?
3Y0PI, I think, was 1995, if I'm not mistaken. I'm trying to remember. Got the QSL card somewhere, well, in the DX file. So I'm picturing that beautiful QSL card with all the pictures on it. I think it was 1995, Dick, if I'm not mistaken, over.
Okay, that's 14 years ago. It's disappointing that this antenna with apparently higher performance hasn't turned into a commercial product. Well, occasionally that happens. Occasionally a good idea goes dormant for a ridiculous length of time, and then somebody rediscovers it. Okay. Maybe it's time for the smart guys in Dover Street to start manufacturing these antennas and make a whole lot of money. The problem you'll then have, Mel, you'll have to buy a bigger wheelbarrow to take all that money to the bank. K2KE1, K2RIW.
I don't think you're ever going to get rich on a ham market. I was thinking fractal antennas. Basically, that's how we got started on this. You know, if we look at the log periodic, can we say a log periodic can sort of be in some way considered, you know, the way it works is sometimes a little difficult to understand the log periodic, but can we say that a log periodic in some way is in a form of a fractal, some kind of a fractal design, Dick, over?
I'd say no. Here's my understanding of a planar type log periodic, and some of them are pyramid shaped. Let's talk about the planar one. You got a bunch of crisscross. You got a what you and I would call twin lead, and between each element, the twin lead flips 180 degrees. It's got a 180 degree twist to it. Can you do that with individual bars? You feed the front of the log periodic where the elements are very short. And you got a bunch of crisscrosses between each of these elements, and eventually you come to the last element, the long one at the back. And then the crisscross feeding device, the twin lead going down the center, either goes into a resistor or into a short circuit with or without a stub. As you're transmitting with this antenna, the RF energy is flowing down that crisscrossed twin lead down the center of the log periodic until it hits the first, let me call it director, which is near the right resonant frequency. So in general, a log periodic, depending on your log taper ratio, let me drop, will have two, three, or four elements that are near the resonant frequency for the particular frequency you're using now. And those are the only elements that will light up. The other elements are so reactive, they absorb no power. The elements that are too short for your operating frequency do nothing. They become a slight capacitive perturbation on the crisscross twin lead. And the signals that are, the elements that are too long, they don't get very much signal because it's already been radiated by the elements that are resonant. So as you're on a particular frequency, you're lighting up two, three, or four elements, depending on the rate of taper of the elements. They radiate in a Yagi-like or Yagi-like manner, but it's an all-element fed. There are no parasitic elements. Go to a higher frequency, and the elements up front, the shorter elements, do all the radiating. Go to a lower frequency, the elements in the back. Lots of people have wanted to use a log periodic as the feed horn for a parabolic dish. The slight problem exists in that the phase center of the antenna shifts rearward as you go to a lower frequency. So which portion of the log periodic do you put at the focal point of the parabolic dish? The parabolic dish has a very long focal length because it's a very flat dish. That becomes a minor academic problem. But for a deep dish, a log periodic is not the best feeding antennas. Well, you do a compromise. You decide which one of the frequencies you care about most, and that portion of the log periodic, you make sure it's at the focal point of the parabolic dish. So a log periodic really is an all-element fed Yagi, and it has a certain relationship to a cavity-backed spiral antenna, but I'll get into that on the next transmission. But I wonder if that much made sense so far, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Why, I can picture it almost like some kind of a fractal type of antenna. All right, so a log periodic, let me see if I can put it into other words. We call them log periodic because the ratio of spacing and elements sizes are the antenna is actually a log periodic because the ratio of spacing and element sizes distributed so that the comparison of one with the next biggest one is a constant, and because the ratios are constant, the log of the ratios is a constant difference at the same time. Am I correct? In other words, am I putting it into the right words, Vic? Am I picturing it into the right words? Over.
I think you are, or you're very close. The argument of the log, I think, is there's a frequency term in there. So as you change the frequency, and it's really a 1 over frequency term, and you take the log of it, those answers for the individual elements represent their length and or spacing. I think it's mostly length. Many of the log periodic designs look like the spacing. Oh, yes, it is both length and spacing. It's changing following a logarithmic curve. And so that's a way of getting broad banding. And by way of the crisscross twin lead that goes down the center of the antenna, and there's multiple ways of doing that crisscross. You can have two parallel lines, but you connect the individual elements alternately. In other words, the first element connects to the right side of the twin lead, and the second element connects to the left side, so to speak. So there's multiple ways that you can get phase difference between the elements, whether you do it with crisscross, an equal length element, or you connect them in a funny way where they reach across, so to speak, the twin lead. Those are minor details. But in my mind, there is a huge difference between log periodic and fractal. The Mandelblot plots, as they're called, I think, for the fractal technique is not necessarily logarithmic. It's got a different kind of equation where you start off with a seed number and you keep feeding it back in a particular way, and that tells you the new position of the plot. And when you do it correctly, it gives you this funny step and repeat pattern that keeps changing in size as you proceed. So, in my mind, the fractal technique is a method of meandering. It's a method of making the electrical length longer than the physical length of the total page, so to speak. So it's a meandering technique. And the articles written by various people would lead you to believe that a fractal type antenna has some brand new breakthrough in gain. I'm very skeptical on that one. If you give me a brand new bandwidth because of the way it meanders, I'm going to accept that. But a brand new gain that within the same amount of real estate, the same number of square feet of sheet metal that's doing the radiating, within that number of square feet of sheet metal, I can set up a whole lot of dipoles as a phased array or a collinear, or I can build this fractal thing and feed it in one or two points. The articles written to now would lead you to believe you're going to get some tremendous amount of gain increase if you fill up that sheet metal with fractals as opposed to filling it up with dipoles that are properly fed. I do not believe that. You can't get gain without area. The effective area of the antenna, the effective capture area, whether you're transmitting or receiving. And fold that area, fold those radiating elements any way you want to. Just because they're folded doesn't give you more gain. Just because there are more elements doesn't give you more gain. but if you distribute those elements over a wider number of square feet and properly feed them, yes, you're going to get more gain. A parabolic dish has more gain if you make the parabola larger. You get a larger radiating area. And fractals, if I take the number of square feet of parabolic reflector and I take the same number of square feet of fractal, the fractal is not going to have more gain than that same number of square feet of parabolic reflector. That's what I believe right now, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
The reason I bring it up, because in the back of my mind, and I got to go search it out, in Krauss's book, J. Krauss, Antennas, McGraw-Hill, 1985 version, on log periodic, I remember a sketch of the first log periodic and how it was laid out on paper to understand its operation. And for some reason, it looked like to me like a fractal antenna. I don't have the book here. Dick, I can almost picture it. On the log periodic, 1985 edition of J. Krauss's Antennas. Do you recall, well, I guess, I don't know why I recall it, Dick, over.
Okay, I've got all three editions of Krauss. His first, second, and third edition. First edition, 1950. I think the second edition is 85, and I think the third edition is somewhere in the 90s. You tell me what page number of the second edition, I'll go get my copy of Krauss, and we'll both look at it at the same time.
Hey, I've got to see if I can find it. I haven't seen it for a while. It was 1985, I am sure of it, as 85, because that was the one book I think I got that was the one that was in the best shape. That's why I only remember it. The other ones are all second-hand books, so they, just to say the least. But if I remember the 85, if I remember on the log periodic, the sketch, the schematic, as you would say, of it, it looked like a fractal type of some kind of configuration. I remember it looked like cutout. Like it would make a fractal cutout with the coaxial line coming in on one side, the ground plane, the description of the tooth, sort of the tooth. I think it was described, if I'm not mistaken, as some kind of tooth affair, Dick, over.
So there are various kinds of log periodics where the individual elements are built as shallow triangles, so that they almost look like shark teeth. Is that what you're describing, Mel? Go ahead. And by the way, do you have access to your 1985 Krauss right now, or should we save that till next week? The choice is yours.
No, I don't know where it is. Do you have yours handy, Dick? I can tell you approximately where it is, over.
Okay. I know which bookshelf mine is on. It'll take me 60 seconds to get there and come back. You want to enter into some particular subject for that minute or minute and a half, and I'll come back with the 85th issue.
I was going to get into another subject, which is a very interesting discussion, but let's stick to this for one more minute. We'll say a couple more minutes, but, you know, there's more to this fractal antenna design than meets the eye, and I have a feeling that it needs further investigation. As Howie said, yes, we used to do that. We used to bend antennas to the weirdest shape, and who knows? Maybe we had the best of antenna designs when they were bent into the weird shape, you know, the wires going this way and that way and all that kind of stuff. And then, of course, as we got older and we got more real estate, we got more sophisticated, we started stretching that dipole straight so that it could be aligned with the, I don't know, what do we say, the Andromeda Galaxy or something. It looked so perfectly straight. But maybe... bending it, as Lance often said, bending the wires and all, a better situation for making the antenna more effective. I don't know, Dick. It's just so much food for thought. Like I say, it has to be experimented on because there may be more than we actually considered. Did you find the 85 edition? Over.
listening, looking. Let me stand by if anybody else wants to come and say from outside via the internet or whatever. This is KTKEY and K2RAW and the group here on the Limark TechNet. Anybody out there, let me let it drop, that would like to join us.
Everybody. I'm a fugitive from the VHF contest, so I'm just showing up in 2MB.
Hiya there, Barry. Okay. We're just doing our usual discussion here on antennas and all. Okay, let me see if Dick is back. Dick, did you find a copy of Mr. Krause and the 1985 edition? Over.
Murphy's Law has struck. I found the 1950, I found the 2002. In other words, I got the first and the third edition. The second edition has fallen off the face of the earth. Hello to Barry, and while Barry talks, I'm going to be dialing in the log periodic section. Go ahead, Barry.
I got nothing to say. I'm just showing up to listen, basically. I was just fooling around with the VHF contest. I wish to tell everybody that VHF is still alive and well. And there was a lot of activity on the contest in this September contest, more than I would have thought to find. So that's a good thing. And 2MB.
Okay. Give us a couple of words, because a lot of these guys are VHF oriented. What's the magic band doing, 6 meters? If I know you, you were on 432, 1296, and maybe 6 meters. And 2 meters, 2 meters side band, I'm sure. Give us a little bit of a rundown of what kind of DX, how many people, how much activity, which band, whatever you like, Barry, go ahead.
Okay, I'll give it real quick. Of course, 2 meters occupied most of the activity. Band conditions could not have been worse. I was watching all the tropospheric ducting forecasts and everything, and they completely flattened just in time for the contest. All week long they were great, really good. And as soon as we got up to contest moment, everything dropped dead. But 6 meters, of course, was pretty good. I worked down to Florida and up to Maine and into Canada. And the same thing on 2 and 432. And, of course, 1296. I worked the furthest I got on 1296, let me think about that. I got to look at my list, but it was Virginia, and up to Maine, of course. K1WHS up in Maine, he's always on, things like that. And there was a lot of, I wasn't a big, contester. I don't normally do that, but I did spend a lot of time listening and calling people, and I got to tell you, in spite of what everybody thinks, there was a lot of activity. Most people made hundreds of contacts, and that's really pretty good. And 2MB.
Now, the good news about a bad condition contest is that it allows the people with good equipment, like you take, for instance, Dave Olean, K1WHS in Lebanon, Maine. He's got his own local mountain in his backyard that he purchased, and all of his equipment on 100 and 150 foot high towers are set up on the top of that mountain. And I don't know if you've ever visited him. To ride in his little car that takes you to the top of that mountain is quite an experience. He's got his own little generator up top, I think it's about a 5 or 10 kilowatt, maybe 15 kilowatt generator that runs that shed where it's just loaded with all kinds of transmitters and receivers. So he fills it up with people and equipment, pours a lot of power into it, to a lot of antennas. His 6-meter antenna, I think, is a vertical stacked array that takes up 100 or 150 feet of a tower. And it lights up the whole East Coast. And so does he make contacts. So with equipment like that, the band being closed doesn't hurt him at all. Whereas when you get a band opening, it's the guy that knows how to run 10 QSOs in 1 minute, and he's got another person alongside of him writing as fast as he can in the logbook. So an extremely fast operator dominates when you get massive band openings. But it's a guy who's got really big equipment that dominates in the case of closed bands. So I wonder if that's sort of what you saw. claiming that he was able to light up the whole East Coast with that vertically stacked 6-meter array. Back to you, Barry. Into Mike Bravo, K2LAW.
Wrong microphone. There you go. Yeah, I noticed that Dave was able to work down into, he was getting down to Georgia. So was I, by the way. But, for him to do it, it's a little more difficult. And I don't know what he was working out to Midwest, because his antennas are so good that when he turns his antennas that way, I don't hear him. But he seemed to be doing very good. And everybody was saying it was remarkable that there was so much activity, because everybody was thinking that there wasn't going to be much. It's a shame, though, that the band didn't open, because it was the day before. And we really had fairly good band conditions, and just in time for the contest, it was really flat. I would have liked to see a band opening. It would have been more exciting.
You were in the contest, I believe it starts at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday and ends roughly now on Sunday night. Were you in there for 50% of that time? Did you do some sleeping last night? Barry, go ahead.
About 60-70% of the time I was on, pretty much. About 70% of the time, 75% of the time I was actually on.
And 2 meters was your best band. Was 432 your highest band? And how many elements, how many Yagis are you running on 432? With how many watts?
Not a lot of anything these days. Really not much. I've got a single RIW on 432. Familiar with that antenna? Maybe you are. I got a Loop Yagi on 1296. I think I have a six-element beam on 6 meters. And got some kind of about a 16-element thing on 2 meters. So it's not very elaborate equipment. Low-loss feed lines and all that. So, and it was working very well.
Sounds like fun. Mel, I did find on page 386 what he calls frequency-independent antennas, the Rumsey principle. And in one of those, he starts off with a triangle, and then the triangle at the feed point becomes more and more toothed, gets more and more elaborate. He's got a logarithmic spiral. And then he's got this thing called self-complementary tooth log periodic antenna of Duhamel and Isabel. Now, this thing is a sheet of metal with a whole bunch of funny tooth things cut out into it and a quasi-circular pattern. And I think this thing radiates broadside. So it does have some characteristics like a fractal. And maybe that's the one you're thinking of, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Exactly where that book went to. I found yours. I thought they took off together. The Duhamel and the Isbell work that was done in the 1950s on the log periodic, and then summarized in Krause's book, and it looks like, that's why I thought of it as, I thought it was a type of fractal antenna. I would say to you that it is the, it looks like something that a fractal antenna would be designed around. It has that tooth type of, I could say, cutout. And looks like it's a mirrored image of one over the other. That's the way it was drawn in two halves with the coaxial line in the middle. Dick, is that the one you're looking at? Over.
That's the one I'm looking at. The coax cable looks like a piece of semi-rigid coming in from the left-hand side. And yes, the two halves of the pattern look like a mirror image of each other. In one case, this metal, in the other case, is cut out. So if you took the right-hand side of the antenna and folded it over to the left-hand side, metal would lay on top of space, space would lay on top of metal. That's the way the symmetry, or quasi-symmetry, from left side to right side. But you feed the left side with the shield of the coax cable, you feed the right side with the center conductor. The RF energy sped down those two center triangular posts, I'm going to call it, until it runs into a tooth that is the right length. and then it radiates from that too. That's where the broadband is coming from. So in that thing that has a fractal-like pattern to it, it really is not meandered with a fractal. The RF energy flows down that center structure until it finds a curved tooth of the right length that resonates and then radiates. And I've said it so often that every one of these antennas that you and I ever use, other than Barry's beverage antenna that he's going to build someday, or a diamond antenna, why can't I think of it? Rhombic, I don't know, rhombic. Other than those antennas that are multiple wavelengths long, the only way, let me drop, the only way you can radiate RF signal is you got to create a lot of RF current somewhere. The RF current creates a magnetic field, the magnetic field that does the real radiating. If you take apart any of the antenna modeling programs, it adds up all the little components of current, figures out what those components of current are when they're summed together in all the finite elements that are being analyzed. It then figures out how much magnetic field is made by each minor component of the current, adds up all those magnetic fields. And the bottom line is how much current flows over how many feet or inches of antenna determines how much energy you radiate. Well, if the antenna is made out of lossless materials and you keep pumping energy into it, it's very similar to what happens when you're pushing your daughter on the swing. When you're pushing Julie on the swing that used to sit out in back of Doyle Street, of Dover Street. As long as you push her in the right periods of time, the total amount of swinging energy continuously increases up to the point where you either build up enough wind resistance or enough bearing resistance at the top of the swing, or you decide that she's swinging high enough that you're not going to go any further. But by putting energy into a resonant system, the current and voltage continuously builds up until the current is high enough to finally radiate. So it takes resonance to do that. The reason why you don't have to resonate a beverage or a log periodic is it does it the other way around. It accepts the fact that the current is a small number, but is now distributed over so many wavelengths of wire that, again, you eventually radiate most of the signal. And because you've got some real estate involved, you have the ability to derive some directivity out of the thing. But for antennas of moderate to small gain, you've got to resonate the elements. It's the only way you can build up a high enough current to do the amount of radiation you want, because radiation is hard. You put 100 milliamps of current through a piece of wire, and it's not going to give you a very strong magnetic field. It's not going to give you very much radiated signal. Only when you resonate it can you make that current build up into many amperes until finally the magnetic field is strong enough that it radiates all the power you're putting into it. And so log periodic and Yagi
repeater, timeout.
Log periodic, Yagi, dipoles, all of these antennas have to essentially resonate in order to build up the amount of current required to do the radiation. Fractal is a meandering way of resonating. This log periodic is a way of getting a broad band kind of radiation. You just choose the element tooth of the right length, and he does the radiating for you. But he's radiating with a small number of dipoles. You're not going to develop super gain with this thing. You do develop super bandwidth. That's the good news. Log periodics give you a lot of bandwidth. But none of the respective log periodic designs have ever gotten much more than 8 dB over isotropic of gain, unless you're willing to use an extremely narrow taper ratio, which really means you're building a very many element Yagi, if you know what I mean. But again, without devoting area, you're not going to get gain. It takes real estate. And I'm not convinced there's a whole lot of magic in the fractal approach. Bandwidth, yes. Super gain, I'm having trouble accepting that. How back to you, Mel. K2LIW.
That's why I questioned it all along, Vic. I was really, surprised at hearing even this 3-4 dB difference in just bending the vertical up somewhat, but it was constant after that.
I don't know. I got to find out until I actually see it happen here. And swinging, the kids in the swing, that's a long, long time ago for us here. I hope they're not doing any swinging, as they say. Hey, Chuck. let's see. Yeah, let's get back to antenna. It's getting late. Kraus, yes. I remember his quote, you know, I guess to sum it up real quick, we can close this off, to sum it up real quick about antennas and Kraus, how he once made a very good statement, and I remember it to this day. There, when in the portion of the book where he gets into radiation pattern and antennas, you know, the radiation pattern, I think it was definitely that section. The radiation pattern, I remember he says a quote, of any antenna can be regarded as the product of two terms. One is the coupling between the antenna, and the other is the phase relationship of the two sources. I think that's what he referred to when he had the his 8JK flat top antenna, known as the Endfire Array. So I guess it still sticks to those sciences, Dick. And, well, we'll see what happens in the future with practical antennas over.
Yeah, I remember him saying, maybe it's not him, but I thought it was him, that the two components of an antenna pattern are a product of the element pattern and the array pattern. You've got some number of elements in your great big antenna, and if you assume each one of them was an isotropic radiator, you end up with a array pattern from those isotropic radiators. Then you figure out what is the real gain of each one of your elements. If it's got a dipole-like pattern or a parabolic-like pattern, whatever. And you take the pattern gain of one element, the array gain of the distribution of your elements, assuming they're isotropic, and you're doing this as real gain numbers, not as decibels yet, and you multiply one pattern by the other. Element pattern times array pattern is the overall pattern. Element gain times array gain is the overall gain in that particular direction. Those are the two elements, the two subparticles of the gain or pattern picture that I remember, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW. And do you want to read any one of the letters? It's your choice. We've got 8 minutes or so left.
You know, we're getting off into a little different affair because, you know, according to there was a quote that was made by, what the heck was his name? Shulkinoff, yes. There was work done by a person by the name Shulkinoff, and about his work on dipoles and spacing of dipoles and all, and how he quoted something similar to that, Dick. I can remember that. I'd have to range in my mind because it's getting late, so I don't remember it that well. But, yeah, okay, let's let that go. You know, an interesting discussion the other night, I'll just touch upon this real quick, I don't know if we can cover it much tonight, because it's getting late, is what is the possibility, do you believe, that we could have, you know, because all they talk about is these trips to Mars and establishing Mars bases. What do you think is the possibility of we'll be able to use HF communication on Mars, Dick? Over.
I think it's very poor. HF propagation beyond the horizon requires an ionosphere. An ionosphere requires a significant atmosphere. Without atmosphere, you don't have the raw ingredients for the ionosphere. Mars has 0.7% of our atmospheric pressure. There's very little air there. I wouldn't say there's zero ionosphere, but Mars is almost twice the distance from the Sun. Our ionosphere is being ionized by solar radiation, and Mars is getting 1/4 the amount of radiation and has less than 1/100th of our atmosphere. You put that all together, I think Mars has 1/1000th of our amount of ionosphere. As such, the the maximum usable frequency on Mars is going to be some extremely low number. So I don't think there's much upper HF propagation between ground sites on Mars. And if it comes through sending a signal from Mars back to Earth, you want to direct that signal like a pencil beam because you've got 300 million miles to cover. With a great big dish on a very high frequency, I can do that directivity. You do that on HF from Mars, where you get a hell of a lot less gain, and you got to contend with atmospheric noise and all the other galactic noise, you got HF frequencies. Unless you're willing to radiate a megawatt of HF power on Mars, I don't think a guy on the Earth is going to hear it. There are guys who have heard the noise coming out of Jupiter on HF frequencies, but that source of energy on Jupiter, I think, is megawatts of power. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I'm not talking about making contact on HF between Earth and Mars. I'm talking about if they establish a number of bases on Mars, they will have to have a communication between bases. Do you think that it will be possible to have some kind of HF communication between bases on the surface of Mars take over?
I think the answer is no. My quick back-of-the-envelope calculation tells me the ionosphere in Mars is 1/1,000th the amount of ionosphere we've got on the Earth. So I don't think it's going to support very much HF. I think the majority of communication base-to-base on Mars is going to be over-the-horizon propagation on VHF, UHF frequencies, or more likely, all of those satellites you've got in orbit, you're going to use them to communicate between your base stations. That's what I think, Mel. Go ahead.
Well, because in the Martian ionosphere, will the electron density be sufficient to refract the transmitted radio signals back to the surface? That's the question. In other words, do they have a sufficient ionosphere? because, you know, or are we looking at, you know, tremendous attenuation at sometimes like we get on the Earth here? Excessive, you know, absorption of this radio signal on Earth, which can cause, you know, anywhere from 0 to 20 dB, you know, attenuation on a single hump here on the Earth. Are we going to experience something similar on Mars, or do they have a sufficient ionosphere there to reflect any kind of signal back on HF? I was really wondering this. That's a good question. I wonder if it's ever been looked into over.
I hear you, but I'm worried. Mars has almost no magnetic field. Mars has almost no Van Allen belt. Mars has almost no air by our standards. It's almost a vacuum, or it's equivalent to the air pressure we've got at about 100,000 feet or some crazy number like that. So the raw ingredients and very little solar wind, solar radiation, because of the distance from the sun. So it's lacking all the ingredients to give you a good ionosphere. I think some of our ionosphere is being affected by the Van Allen belt. I don't think it's got one. Doesn't have the magnetic field to get one. Doesn't have an aurora borealis. I don't think there's an aurora on Mars. Don't think they've ever seen one. And there's a relationship between the ionosphere and an aurora. If you don't have an aurora, you're lacking some of the raw ingredients for an ionosphere. So right now, I'm not impressed with the HF propagation characteristics on Mars. I think it's going to have to be VHF and satellite. That's my guess. We've only got about a minute left. This was TechNet number 1,262 of the series that began 27 years ago, September of 1982. Bye-bye, you all. Try to slowly educate the people in Bayville, Long Island, that radio is good. It's their friend. It's not their enemy. It's going to take some education. 73, you all be kind to each other, particularly the radio-fearing people in Bayville. K2KEY, K2RIW, you got a bell.
Very good. It's a very interesting subject, and of course, enjoy doing it every week. And so I guess the Delta Mathis Cup, also known as the Mars Cup, that sits at the ARL, it's been very secure there for a long time.
I don't think anybody's going to make any HF communications with Mars soon. 73s, everybody. Take care. Have a great week. This is K2KEY. Good night, all.
Good night, Joseph.
Hey, Dead K2RIW. Good night, Mel. Have a really nice week. Mel, have a nice holiday next week. WB2HWW. Good job to you, Mel.
You too, Howie. You and the family. Everybody, I forgot to say that, really. Everybody that's celebrating the Jewish holidays, have a great holiday and good luck in the new year.
73, nice week.
Because of the holiday next week, will that mean we might have a decreased participation? Mel, what do you think?
It starts Friday night and covers over Sunday. It's free, over.
Very good.
Do you think there's any possibilities of any kind of VHF propagation on Mars? You know, tropospheric ducting, we don't have much of a troposphere, but anything like that?
You can't say it's going to be zero. But when you got so darn little atmosphere, our troposphere for the 0 to 6 miles has got this beautiful gradient where it's dense atmosphere with lots of moisture down low and drier and more tense and more tenuous up high. That gives you a downward bending of the wave. When you've got a small percentage of the atmosphere, the VHF propagation there is going to be kind of yucky. Knife edge diffraction over the mountains, yes. But
12 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2GL.
But real propagation over the hills. Knife edge diffraction, yes. But
at
VHF propagation, I think it's going to be a lots and lots of dBs weaker than we've got on Earth. Not going to be anywhere near as comfortable. You radiate enough signal, you're going to get something through. But if it's going to be 50 dB weaker, it's going to be a lot harder to live with. I'm transmitting on the eastern input, Barry. In fact, I may hear you. Yes, I'll hear you if you transmit to me. The other people listening on 85 won't hear, but the people listening on 147.375 will hear you. N2MB, K2RIW. Because Mars has got something like half of our diameter, that means the Earth curvature, Mars curvature, happens a lot faster. You don't have the super refraction phenomena of our atmosphere. You don't have the ionospheric effect. You don't have sporadic E. You've got knife edge diffraction from the mountains.
Good morning. The time is 12:01.
Over the horizon, it's going to be roughly twice as many decibels of attenuation that we get for the same number of miles on Earth. That's my rough guess, Barry. Go ahead.
Okay, that ought to be interesting, though. And I guess if we're going to be communicating with hams on Mars, which I don't think is going to be happening anytime soon, I guess microwave would be the way to go.
Yeah, microwave gives you a lot of ability to direct that signal at the desirable knife edge. Microwave gives the ability to direct that signal up to the satellites. Microwave gives the ability to focus the signal to get it back to Earth. So I think an awful lot of it's going to be microwave and or fiber optic, optical laser. Laser is another beautiful way. When you got so little atmosphere, laser communication up to the satellite or back to Earth starts looking very desirable. The higher the frequency, the better, Barry. Just like Dr. Tom Williams keeps saying, no frequency is too high, or no frequency is high enough. Back to you, Barry.
Okay. Yeah. It's going to be interesting. And I guess I haven't been listening to everybody's technical stuff. So I came in really late. But what's happening with our supposed Mars mission and all that stuff, I think that's a little pie in the sky, you know?